Most of the time, comments read on YouTube are ignorant, misinformed, completely ridiculous, sometimes unabashedly homophobic, downright racist. It's the anonymity of the internet that allows people to speak freely, and for some, that means expressing just how big an asshole they really are. However, there is always a flip side, and one day, while combing through YouTube comments on a video of ours, I stumbled on an interesting comment someone had left. He or she wanted to know if I knew that Marty Friedman really dug our band. And I did a double take. Marty Friedman? You mean the Marty Friedman that made up one half of the legendary guitar virtuoso duo Cacophony? You mean the Marty Friedman that played on the most successful Megadeth records for 10 years? The Marty Friedman on Rust in Peace, Countdown to Extinction, Euthanasia? So I did what anyone would do, armed with a sole YouTube comment, gathered up enough courage, and emailed his website. I wrote to whoever the webmaster was and said that I was a big fan of Marty's, and, well, it worked. Marty wrote me back himself, and we've been pals ever since. He now lives in Tokyo, and he's very active in the Japanese music scene, whether it's putting out his own records like Future Addict, Tokyo Jukebox, Bad DNA, Tokyo Jukebox 2, or guesting on television shows, guesting on albums, lending his voice to Metalocalypse, guesting on video games. It goes on and on. But the one thing I quickly learned about Marty Friedman is that he's a very big Kiss fan, and it was easy to bond on that alone. A few months back, when I did a podcast with Uber Kiss fanatic and fellow podcaster Cassius Morris, Marty Friedman was the first person I emailed, and I told him to listen to the episode. Undoubtedly, he was impressed with Cassius, and it gave me an idea. Why not do a similar Kiss-only sit-down discussion with Marty, too? He agreed, and this episode is us talking about our favorite band, the hottest band in the land, Kiss. Now, Marty's in Tokyo, and I'm in Toronto. So, once again, we did this podcast via Skype. But I got to tell you, the volume levels, the quality of reception, it was great. I can't help but attribute it to our sponsor, Blue Mic Microphones. It's episodes like this one, done through Skype, when you really can value the Yeti Blue Mics. So thank you to Blue Mics. We use these for every podcast episode. Thanks also to Skull Candy Headphones and Vans Shoes. And I also want to give a special thanks to Will Carroll, drummer of Death Angel. Because as you'll hear in the podcast, he provided me with some great Kiss stories that I relayed over to Marty. You just got to listen to it. So thanks to Will. Thanks to Ted as well. Hell, thanks to all the dudes in Death Angel for this episode too. Also, please keep those ratings and reviews coming on iTunes. It really helps the podcast's profile. Just recently, in the Canadian iTunes store, our podcast was listed under the What's Hot section. So that was cool. Thanks to Don from Eastern Canada. Thanks to 666 Corey. And thank you to Kelly Ann on NSC for all your comments. I very much appreciate them. And I'm assuming the SC in Kellyanne on SC stands for SoundCloud. And yes, you can also hear this episode and all the old episodes now on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Danko Jones. Okay, guys, here it is. This is great. This is the legendary, the incredible, the fantastic, fabulous Marty Friedman on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now.
Hey, man.
Hey, Marty. How's it going?
That's pretty good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing really good. Are you ready to do this Kiss podcast together?
Yeah, man, let's do it.
Cool. So the last time I did a podcast about Kiss. It was with Cassius Morris, who runs the Creatures of the Net podcast, who's 13 years old. He knows everything about Kiss, quite impressive. And when it was uploaded on iTunes, I sent you an email because I know you're like the biggest Kiss fan I know. And I said, Marty, you gotta listen to this kid talk about Kiss. And you were fairly impressed with him.
Yeah, I was really impressed, man. I mean, it was like he was there in real time, and he's only 13. I mean, that like freaked me out.
Yeah, he's got an opinion for every era, every member, every record. It was amazing. And so, you know, I hatched the idea to like do one with you. Maybe we can do this as a regular thing, talking about Kiss. And, you know, the first time we met, the one thing I noticed on you, on your person, was you were wearing full-on Kiss boots.
It's very possible, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that told me that, you know, I'm dealing with a huge Kiss fan. And since then, you've sent me some Kiss bootlegs that I've enjoyed in the car, rocking out. Very cool.
Cool. Oh, cool. Yeah, you can tell that just from the boots.
Oh yeah, man, those were jean boots, right?
No, they're just like rad boots. They weren't like really supposed to be any Kiss type of thing, but I guess they look kind of like something Gene would have worn.
Oh, okay, because I thought those were Kiss boots. I've told so many people that. I'm like, Marty Friedman is the biggest Kiss fan, man. When I met him, that dude was wearing Kiss boots.
That's the funniest thing I ever heard.
I've said great, that to man. So many people. I'm like, no, Marty's the biggest Kiss fan, man. I've never met a bigger Kiss fan. That's why I even said right 2 minutes ago, I'm like, Marty, you're the biggest Kiss fan I know, man. You got the boots.
Dude, that's some funny shit, man. It's kind of embarrassing, too, but it's pretty funny.
Oh, man. If someone was going around telling people that I was walking around in Kiss boots, I wouldn't deny it.
That's some funny shit, man.
But listen, well, the three topics that, you know, I wanted to talk to Cassius about are the same three topics I want to talk to you about. And the first topic is the latest kind of sensational book that's been out on Kiss, and it has nothing to do with Gene or Paul putting out anything. It's from Ace Frehley, his autobiography, which was put out very timely before Christmas, No Regrets. And Ace kind of spills the beans. It's kind of a tell-all book, something that we've been waiting for Ace to write for a long time. But, you know, no one really expected him to put it out, and here he did it.
Yeah.
I was impressed. Have you had a chance to read the book?
Yes, I enjoyed it thoroughly. I read it like in a heartbeat. It was so easy to read.
Yeah, and you know, it's about someone that we are both very interested in and obsessed about. Really, I mean, you could read it like in a day. I almost did.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you're interested in something, it's amazing how fast you can read it.
I was really kind of glad that he kind of took a couple of shots at Gene, more than a couple, and a few shots at Paul.
Yeah.
I think it was deserved, you know, after all the shots that Gene and Paul have taken with Ace and
Peter. Yeah, it was definitely made for interesting reading on that point, but looking at the whole story, it says a lot about how much magic Ace's playing had within the sound of Kiss. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about Gene and Paul's character, and you think about Ace's character, think about how hard it was for Gene and Paul to put up with his bullshit, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you could get like any bar guitar player that could play like the kind of rock and roll type of stuff that is necessary to be in Kiss.
Yeah.
But there was something about Ace's playing that he, within his limited vocabulary, he managed to make every single solo sound completely only made for that song, completely hummable, completely like the magic, the absolute magic, the perfect thing. And the fans loved him. We all loved him. He looked so cool. It was just so perfect. But if you look at all the bullshit that he probably put Gene and Paul through, I mean, like that one story about, like there was like a deer in his swimming pool, so he missed a gig or something. He couldn't get to the gig. It's like if there's a deer in your swimming pool, fuck it, you just go to the gig. You know, you imagine Gene on the other end of the phone. Oh, dude, there's a deer in my swimming pool. I can't make it to California, whatever. Yeah. I mean, that shit must have happened like billions of times.
Yeah.
So I really gotta like, you know, hand it to Gene and Paul for like really doing it for the fans, because, you know, there's a lot of really good guitar players that go in and out of Kiss, but like you and I know that it's the magic. Yeah. And we want the stuff to be played like Ace, preferably by Ace.
Yeah.
Because that's just the magical, magical stuff. But like reading the book, it's like, who can keep a job doing all that kind of insane stuff? I mean, it says a lot about the value of Ace's magic within Kiss framework. I mean, what do you think about that?
I do agree. I mean, you know, Gene doesn't really have, I think now with Family Jewels, he's kind of realized he needs a PR makeover, and his family kind of tearing him apart on TV is helping that. And you know, my mom knows who Gene Simmons is now and likes him. I think with the fans, he's badly needed that PR image makeover for a long, long time. But we don't really think about, like you're saying, like all the crap him and Paul have had to put up. And I think Gene's got, I think Paul's got a little more tolerance for it than Gene does. Ace mentions this very touching moment where, you know, he was ready to leave the band around Creatures of the Night, and Paul, in a last-ditch attempt, hung out with him for a day. They went shopping, you know, together.
Yeah.
Just trying to keep it all together. And I've been on, you know, being in a band, as you know, like, you know, there's different dynamics, different personalities get jammed together because you guys are the guys who can play these songs. And as you tour, you really get to know people. I kind of identify more with Gene and Paul than I do with Peter and Ace in that respect, because, you know, I'm more like trying to keep the ship afloat sometimes when, you know, personalities clash. So I get Gene on that level, but I understand like just the average Kiss fan just going, man, you're picking on Ace too much. But you don't realize like Ace is probably like, like you said, like missed gigs and, you know, flubbed solos because he's, you know, in God knows what state of mind.
It's all his mistakes. It's not because of some other people's problems. It's all completely by his own making. You know, it's all completely his own irresponsibility. And you know, you have your own band for a long time, and it's your name that's on the line. And keeping your band afloat and kicking ass and doing good all around the world, if you got somebody who's in that band that, like, you can't be sure he's going to be there, you're not really sure what's going to happen, you know just how much stress and how hard that is to deal with.
Yeah, totally. God.
And, like, but, you know, like you and I both know, with those Kiss magic of the four original members, that it's like unlike any other band, that kind of magic. So Gene and Paul realize that, I'm sure, and, like, really probably constantly was under a lot of stress because of not knowing whether Ace is going to be able to do whatever he's supposed to do or not.
Well, this leads into the second topic that I wanted to talk to you about, and I talked to Cassius about, which is a very, very controversial topic within the Kiss Army, and that's new members wearing the old makeup. Basically, Tommy Thayer wearing Ace's makeup on lead guitar, and Eric Singer wearing Peter Criss's cat makeup. What is your stand on that?
I think that theoretically it's the best thing that's happened, and without it, Kiss wouldn't be doing what they're doing now, which is still playing big shows and sounding better than ever. I mean, let's face it, if you were to listen to say a board tape of now and a board tape of like the magic time, theoretically, sonically, it's going to sound better now.
Agreed.
Sonically, it's going to sound better now. But the magic time, like it before 1980, it probably had those magical moments that you could never get now, but that's a whole other story. But I think that the new members now, only Tommy and Eric can do, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that they do it right. Like when in the non-makeup era, when they did the makeup era songs, I just thought it sucked beyond belief. You know, I just thought, you know, I'm one of those guys who believes in the original four, the magic of the great era and stuff.
Right.
And especially Tommy, he really, really, he's a good guitar player, but he really becomes Ace. And as a fan of Ace, it's really pretty much the next best thing. I mean, I would much rather see Ace there, like straight, looking cool and playing great. Like when I saw him in 96, the first reunion tour, it was like, you know, I could have died that moment. It was so good. But like, it's not going to happen because, you know, the personalities and just Ace is not really into it like the rest of the guys are.
Yeah.
So like, I think Tommy Thayer is like a blessing to have someone who's that faithful to the vision of Kiss. I mean, he's obviously playing from a Kiss standpoint. I think I would do the same thing. I mean, if I were asked to join Kiss, I'd love to just play Ace's stuff exactly the way it is on the record.
Okay. Now here's my question to you. If you would join Kiss, and you're probably one of the very few people I'm ever going to speak to that could very well take Tommy's place tomorrow, the question is, would you wear the spaceman's makeup? Or would you prefer, regardless of what Gene and Paul tell you to do, would you prefer to wear a new set of makeup, like become a new character?
I think it's a good question, but I think it's late in the game to start adding new characters. As a maniac fan, I mean, you know, I've had my own career obviously since that, but like when it comes to talking about shit that I really dig, like Kiss, you know, I would immediately revert to my 13, 14-year-old self and say, shit, yeah, put that makeup on. I'm going to play the solo exactly note for note. I would just be loving every minute about it. Like, you know, just completely, purely loving it like that. And I would, but here's a funny story. Right around 1982 or something, right when Ace was like kind of out of the band, I got a call from Kiss and asking if I was interested in auditioning for guitar. But the first thing they asked, they said, dude, I got this through Mike Varney. They asked him to call me up and ask these questions. Are you skinny? I'm like, yeah. Do you have long hair? Like, yeah. And how tall are you? I'm like, well, I'm 5'7½". And that was out. You got to be like 6 feet without heels.
Wow.
So I was like, holy shit, I'll do something. I'll have an operation, whatever it takes. Is there like a body stretching operation? I'll do it. I mean, fuck, I was out because I was too short.
But here's the thing is Eric Singer is short. He's not.
Well, I guess it's different for the front line guys because I know Eric's about my size, but the front three guys, I mean, I totally get it. I mean, those two, Paul and Gene, are huge. So like I would look kind of goofy next to them.
Wow, an amazing fact I didn't know about, and that is amazing. Now, were you heartbroken?
I was very heartbroken, but I was even more heartbroken when Bruce Kulick, you know, I think he's a wonderful, wonderful guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't know if it was by Gene and Paul's direction or what, but, like, when he played the old songs, he would just, like, do these bullshit blues solos in there as if that's all that Ace was doing.
I've heard those, yeah.
To a good guitar player, they might listen to Ace and, it's just a bunch of bluesy shit, man.
Mm.
But it's not.
I know.
I mean, it's not. I mean, it's really the classic shit. I remember humming that shit in my ears in, like, junior high school, knowing each solo to each song, and it's all the same. It's all the same scales and patterns, but, like, there's a magic about it that, like, not every other Jimmy Page clone can do. And so, like, when Bruce Kulick played all these, like, fast kind of guitarish stuff in there, I felt like, man, if I had this gig, I would, like, protect the original stuff and play it right. Why is Gene and Paul allowing this to go on?
Right.
Maybe they're telling him to do something different. I didn't know. You know, I don't want to blame him because I know he's a cool dude and a great guitar player. But I just thought, this is so not the way I would have done it.
I mean, I don't know how much of a Peter Criss fan you are, but over the years I've become a bigger Peter Criss fan than I started out to be. But
I think so. I think, you know, Peter is another one. It's a magic thing. If you take his drumming and just completely solo it, put it out by itself, it's so non-rock and it's so nonsensical. I mean, it really actually is just completely a mismatch, but somehow it is absolutely perfect for Kiss. And when Eric Singer comes in with his really good rock chops, it feels good and it sounds right, but like, no way, man. It's like the way Peter Criss plays the stuff, you know? And Gene told me that, you know, Peter Criss doesn't know the difference between a verse and a chorus and a bridge. He just like plays. And like, technically that may be true, but like there's something about the way he played in the Kiss songs, even though the tempo was not correct all the time and it was probably hellish on the producers and the members. And I know he like speeds up and slows down.
Yeah.
But like you listen to the first couple albums and the first two live albums, it's that drumming, that non-heavy metal drumming that makes Kiss just so weird and cool.
I agree 100%. That kind of chemistry is what makes great bands.
You know,
I always gotta have somebody in the mix who doesn't fit or doesn't come from the same background as the other ones. You know, there's some guy into jazz and we're playing metal. Well, for some reason it adds this taste that separates that band from all the other bands. And
sure,
like you're pointing out, it's the same thing with Peter. And plus, I mean, Peter's voice. I mean,
yeah,
he could sub in for the Faces if he wanted to. You know, or he could do a couple Black Crow songs.
Yeah, he's got a great voice, man.
Well, this leads into the third topic I wanted to talk to you about, which is just basically Kiss collectibles. Now, when I did the first podcast with Cassius, I mentioned I want one of the Kiss items that I needed to get was the Don Ross 78 Kiss card trading card collection. And someone who was listening to the podcast, his name's Lee, he sent me the collection.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so I got that.
The whole collection?
The whole collection. He sent me the Don Ross collection. It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. So that was very nice of him. I'm just making a mention of it now. But it's leading me into this third topic, which is Kiss collectibles. What are some of the collectibles you have that you're most proud of? Now, I guess it's not the boots.
Yeah, it's not the boots. It's not the boots. And actually, I think when you were talking on the last podcast about the collectibles, you are definitely much more knowledgeable than I am about that topic. I had the dolls. I had three of the dolls, and the original dolls.
Oh.
And I don't even remember how I got them. I think a fan gave them to me or something.
Right.
And one of my friends wanted them, and he traded me the Kistory book for it. And I was much more interested in the book than the collectibles. But like being a Kiss fan for all this time, I mean, the fans like to give you stuff, and I got a wonderful Kiss jacket. Like, it was kind of made out of like paper, not paper, but kind of a paperish material. It's like a very paper thin kind of material Kiss jacket. It's kind of psychedelic.
Is it official?
It's from like official from like 1979 or something.
Oh, wow.
Very colorful, like almost like a plastic raincoat type of small jacket. I have that. It's kind of rad, but like, rather than the collectibles, I like the books a lot. I really like the There's one, I think it's called Behind the Mask, maybe, where the KISS members go through all the songs one at a time and talk about the songs. And then there's one called KISS Alive Forever, where they've got every concert and every set list listed and every little detail. This happened in Indianapolis, and this was the last time they ever played room service live or whatever, stuff like that. I'm more into like those kind of things than the goods. So I don't really have too many goods to speak of.
Well, I hear you on that. I love the DVDs they put out a few years back. They had
which one for that?
I can't think of it now. I have all three. The
Kissology thing.
Kissology volumes 1 to 3. I love that.
Yeah.
And I have the Kistry books. Now, do you have Kistry number 2?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Do you?
Yes. Yes. I made the mistake of buying it.
Really?
Yes. And it costs exactly as much as Kistry 1. The only thing is, all it is like pictures of magazines and pictures of collectibles. It's got nothing in it. There's no meat in it. It's just like, oh, we did really well with Kistry 1. What can we do to match it and make a Kistry 2? And it was just these, like, I don't know. I felt disappointed. But since it's been yanked off the Kiss Online store, I've kind of felt vindicated because now it's kind of a rare item because nobody's going to buy that. That's the only way I can feel good about spending that much money on a book. But one of the other books, now that you mentioned you're kind of a KISS book fan, have you read the Lydia Criss book?
Oh, yes.
You have? Oh, yes. Sealed with a Kiss.
Have you got that one too?
I have not. I was really slow to get that because it's not a cheap book. And they're sold out. They've been sold out. And I actually reached out to Lydia, and she replied to me, personally replied, saying that there is a new shipment there's going to be a new run of it very soon. So I'm just kind of waiting for it. But it's not a cheap book, but is it a good book? Is it worth buying?
I'll tell you this. That book is on the level of the first Kistry, if even not better.
Okay, because Kistry 1 rules. Kistry 1
is amazing. Kistry 1 rules. I loved it. It's got a lot of the similar information, but probably that information came from Lydia Criss in the first place.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, she, like, that stuff is in there, man. It's like, especially since you being particularly into Peter, you're going to get the perspective that, like, it doesn't come out as much. It's like we've heard Gene's story so many times.
Yeah.
You know? But, like, the Peter story is, like, very, very interesting. And, yeah, I mean, you're going to love it. Let me just tell you, you'll be so stoked that you got it.
Because I'm willing to throw down the money, but, you know, after my Kistry 2 debacle, I got a little gun-shy.
I will guarantee it. And it's, like, it's dense. I mean, it'll take a long time to get through it.
Oh, mate. Now, they do sell digital copies for $25 a download.
Don't even go there, dude. Don't even go there.
All right. Okay.
Don't even go there. You will be stoked. I mean, I was surprised how good it was. It's dense. I remember, like, when I got it, like, I didn't even know how to start reading it.
Really?
There's, like, tons of text in there and tons of pictures you've never seen before and just, like, tons of early days stuff.
Because that's how I feel when I pick up Kistry 1. I just look at it and I just end up flipping through the pages because I just don't know where to start.
Yeah, that's what it is, man.
Oh, I love that. I love that feeling, man.
It's all good, man.
You know, in terms of collectibles, there was recently... Death Angel came through town, through Toronto, and I was hanging out with those guys. I started talking to Will, their drummer, Will Carroll, about Kiss. Now, he's like a humongous Kiss fan, too, and I just wanted to share with you a couple of stories he told me, and this falls under the topic of Kiss collectibles, And he's got a friend who is an insane Kiss collector. And now Gene had, it's been pointed out, he had a fanzine called, I believe, Cosmo Stiletto.
Right.
He used to do this thing, this Cosmo Stiletto. Now, this guy is well known, I think, by Gene and Paul and some of the Kiss members for being like an Uber fan. So Gene, I guess, when one of his books was up for sale and he was doing the tour, the book tours and stuff, he was doing a signing in a bookstore. This guy showed up to the signing, and instead of presenting Gene with the book that he's supposed to sell, he just put a copy that he had found of Cosmo Stiletto on the table for Gene. And like, apparently, from what Will tells me, Gene just like stopped the presses, just looked at him. He knew who he was, and he just goes, "How much for this?" And he started like, I don't know what he started at, but it got up to like 10 grand, 15. And the guy just kept saying, "No, no, no." He wouldn't reveal how he acquired this fanzine. But finally, Gene just goes, "Okay, well, what do you want for this? Like, this is a copy of his childhood. Like, how many copies were even made? Like, how did this guy get? I don't even know. It's
he never revealed how he got it.
He didn't know. Apparently, according to Will, he never told Gene where he got it from. And when Gene asked him what he wanted for trade, the guy goes, "Your guitar strap from Kiss Alive, the album cover, the guitar strap that you wore on Kiss Alive." And Gene wouldn't give it up. And I don't understand. Maybe Gene's got more copies of Cosmo Stiletto at home. But, man, I'm telling you, this is like something from your childhood.
Dude, that's a great story.
Yeah. And the other story is, for any Kiss fans, or if you're not a Kiss fan, if you look on the back cover of Kiss Alive, the first one, Kiss Alive 1, there is this famous photo of these two kids holding up their Kiss Rules picture. What do you call this? Like a poster? What do you call those things when people go to concerts with huge flyers that say
Kiss? A banner.
A banner, right. The two guys are holding the banner. Now, he found out, and I believe one of those guys ended up in a name band. And he showed up to one of the guys. He found out which guy owns the banner because, I guess, according to the Kiss Army, that's the number one most valued collectible because there's only one in existence. And it's just so famous. It's not just any banner. It's the Kiss Alive banner. So he shows up to this guy's house. He flew out there unannounced. This is all according to Will from Death Angel told me this. Shows up to this guy's house, knocks on his door. The guy opens the door and he goes, "You know, how much for the banner?" And the guy chased him off his property. He found the guy's house? He found out where he lived. And the guy just chased him out of his property. Just going like, you know, you're nuts. That's
some funny shit, man.
But when you think about it, that poster is the most, that banner is the most collectible Kiss item, really. I think that and like copies of Cosmo Stiletto, like I can't think of anything that's more valuable for a Kiss fan to own. I think it's about as valuable for Gene and Paul, too. They'd pay huge sums for it.
You would think that somebody who's a really good artist could make their own copy of that.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. But, you know, Gene would know the contents inside fanzine.
Oh, the fanzine, yeah. I'm talking about the banner.
Oh, the banner.
That banner would be like a rad thing to have in your house.
It would. You know, they should really, someone should really think that could be an item to sell to crazed Kiss fans. Just you could make that banner and sell it online.
That could be
pretty cool.
That was a cool banner too.
Yeah, it really was. And those guys were really on it. When you think about, that was before Kiss Alive. That was just first three albums. They were on Kiss. You know, I think about sometimes I look at the back cover of Kiss Alive and I go, where are all these people now? I'd love to talk to them.
No kidding, man.
Yeah. There's, you know, there's Bill Starkey and everything, but like, who's that guy that, on a date with that girl? Like, what ended up with those guys? You know, like, I think about that sometimes.
That's some funny shit, man.
Yeah. You're out in Tokyo. I'm in Toronto. It's 10 o'clock at night for me, but 11 in the morning for you. What do you got on? What do you got going on over there in Japan?
I'm doing a new album, a new solo album right now. I'm just starting the pre-production stage of that. But before I get deep into that, tomorrow I'm actually going to Singapore to do a lecture at the Music Matters Conference. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's like the MIDEM thing in Cannes, France.
Oh, yeah, right.
Well, I just did that one in February. I'm basically representing the Japanese music business.
Wow.
And talking, doing like a lecture along with the president of Sony Publishing over there, which it sounds a lot more daunting than it is. I'm basically just going to explain my role in the music business in Japan and what my experiences have been and what my experiences are, what I do over here in Japan and stuff like that. And it's basically like go all the way down to Singapore and speak for an hour and then come back kind of thing.
Wow, that sounds heavy, man. That sounds wicked. And then pre-production starts?
Pre-production starts on my solo record, and I'm right in the process. I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but like a lot of my stuff that I've been doing in Japan has yet to be released outside of Japan. And I'm just securing deals all around the world, Europe and America, to release the stuff properly elsewhere. And I'm really excited about that because I've always kind of held back with releasing stuff outside of Japan unless the people who are releasing it really care about it and care about getting it to the people who might dig it, you know?
Right.
And finally, it's come to the point where there are people that are that interested in it and that caring about it. And I'll be able to announce the American one probably within the next week or so.
Oh, wow.
But I'm really excited about that because a lot of people think that I'm over in Japan doing my thing and like fuck everybody else and like what does he think about the fans everywhere else, and it's really couldn't be farther from the truth. And I've just been so consumed by stuff in Japan that I haven't been able to give releases and tours outside of Japan nearly as much consideration as it deserves. So like I toured Europe last year, I'm going to tour Europe again this year, but like hopefully now that I'm going to release stuff in America, I'm going to be able to go back there and do a proper tour and stuff like that. So I'm not ignoring anybody. It's just my plate gets really full over here in Japan, and I don't really like to do half-assed stuff outside of Japan just to say that I did it, you know. So, but it's looking like it's going to happen soon. So
that's amazing. Now, for people listening to the podcast, what exactly are you doing in Japan? You know, of course, it's music-oriented, but what keeps you there music-wise?
Wow, music-wise, I do so much stuff. I do, obviously, my own solo stuff. I release my solo albums and do shows and stuff like that. But I also have quite a lot of appearances on television from every possible kind of program you could imagine, everything from cooking shows to political shows to comedies to musical shows.
Wow.
It's really insane. I've done, like, maybe 450 television shows since I've moved here. It's just
holy
off
cow.
The hook. You know, every possible thing that I could do on TV, I've done. I'm like the same way I am about Kiss. I'm the same way about Elvis Presley. And one time there was a program where I got to bring some really rare Elvis stuff and talk about that, you know, and just I did this thing where I like a cooking show right now. Oh, I told you about this one show that I do where I get to wear this makeup.
Yeah, you sent me the photo.
Yeah, it's like we were in this band called the Black Pirates, and it's a regular skit on, like, I don't want to say Saturday Night Live, but it's kind of like imagine if, like, the Backstreet Boys had a variety TV show and it was like a comedy show. And one of the guys, like the Justin Timberlake guy, is like the lead singer of this like black metal band that I'm the guitar player and I'm the songwriter and producer of. So like I take these songs, these famous songs that everybody knows, and I kind of black metalize it. And then we do this comedy skit on the show, and the skit always ends with us playing that song in front of a full live audience, in full makeup and stuff. It's just so friggin' fun. I can't
even
tell you.
That sounds insane.
It's insane, man. It's insane. I got to do an arrangement and perform with this traditional Japanese singer. I took one of her songs, and I just totally metaled it out big time. And, I mean, it's like taking Barbra Streisand and taking her song and making it full on metal and then having her come out and sing it with you. They're up for that kind of stuff. I mean, I can't really imagine that type of stuff going on back home. I mean, the singer would have to really have an open mind to be willing to destroy one of her own famous songs like that.
Right.
And then get involved in it herself.
Right. You know,
it was on B. Takashi's program that I got to do that.
Wow. And, that's
he's very, very big over here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember him, and I've seen his movies that have made it over here, and it's he's awesome. But Marty, thank you very much for coming down on the podcast. Well, checking in on Skype and doing this podcast.
Oh, dude, it's my pleasure, and even more than that, I'm totally looking forward to your record.
Oh, thank you very much. We just finished tracking.
Yeah, dude, I listen to your CDs all the time.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, I especially like before I played live and stuff and before events and stuff, I always crank your stuff and people always ask who it is because it's fresh and it's pumped and like, I really can't wait till you guys come over and play in Japan. It's just going to be apeshit.
Thanks, man. We went to Japan once, I believe in 03. We played Fuji Rock. And I was so happy to be in Japan. The band that played after us was Sugar Ray.
And, oh, wow.
I mean, I don't dislike Sugar Ray, but I don't have their albums or anything, you know. But I was just so pumped to be in Japan that I was watching them side stage and I was so pumped. It could have been anybody, Rick Astley or anybody. I was just like getting so into Sugar Ray, man, because I was so pumped to be in Japan. Afterwards, I was like, did I just go ape shit for Sugar Ray?
Glad well, that's it wasn't cool. Rick Astley, man.
Yeah, I was like, well, I think Mark McGrath is a cool guy, but I would in any other circumstances, I don't think I would have been that gung-ho watching Sugar Ray. Not that I don't like him or anything, but it was pretty funny.
That's rad, man.
So, yeah, definitely want to go back there.
Awesome.
Wicked, Marty. Thanks a lot, man. I hope I'm not taking too much of your time this morning.
Absolutely. My pleasure, man. Anytime.
Awesome. Thanks, Marty.
Cool. Take care. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, man.
I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.